right here, right now, every day. CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. And how are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Well, we're going to be very fortunate today. We have two very interesting guests. We're going to be subject to basically Rwanda, Burundi, and the second half it'll be Burundi. But right off the top, I want to make sure I announce that there's going to be a draw for the trip to Iceland from the CIUT fundraising, and it will be live on air Sunday, January the 15th, 6 p.m., during the program Across the Universe. And anyone that donated during the fall membership drive campaign up to and including December 31st, 2016, by 11:59 p.m. is eligible for the draw. And that includes any donations that were received by mail, post, and time-stamped before December 31st. So we get clear rules here, and it's you have a shot. So that's going to be – the draw will be January 15th, 6 p.m. during the program Across the Universe. Our first guest today is Portia Karagea. Are you there, Portia?
Yes, I am.
Hello, Portia. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, I want to tell our listeners that your father was a very prominent leader of the Rwanda Patriotic Front. He may have been, and you can, of course, tell us about this, but one of the founding members, certainly a senior figure for many years. And he had difficulties with the leadership of Rwanda, President Paul Kagame, and left the country and went to eventually settled in South Africa. And in South Africa, there were attempts on the life of your father, Patrick Karagea, and on General Yamwasa, a man with a similar profile. Unfortunately and tragically, your father was assassinated. I think we have to say assassinated. He's a political figure, and he was deliberately killed for his politics, we assume, on December 31st, 2013, New Year's Eve. We need to know from you. Tell us about, first of all, who your father's background, and then we'd like to get into the matter of what the motive was behind this and who you feel was responsible.
Sure. I mean, you've more or less covered everything. So my father joined the RPF as a relatively young man, and he was part of the government as a civil servant and was, I suppose it was the rather high position of Director General of External Intelligence for about 10 years. Well, more really, they say 10 years, but around the 8-year mark, he was demoted due to personal conflict to army spokesman. Mm-hmm. And then eventually he was detained at first for 5 months in 2005. Then he was released. And he was rearrested about 8 months later, and he was formally charged with insubordination and desertion, whatever you take that to mean, and sentenced to 18 months in prison, in military jail, which he duly served. And the 5 months detention was counted in that sentence. So he came out at about 13 months.
Uh-huh.
And he was out for about a week when you say he left the country, but he really didn't leave of his own volition. It was under threat of his life.
Yes.
So that is when he escaped through Uganda and Kenya and Tanzania, eventually coming to South Africa simply because, we were his children. We went to school there, so it felt like a good base to be.
Yes.
And then eventually there was another dissident, the former army general and then ambassador to India, Kayumba Nyamwasa, who also fled to South Africa in 2008, which wasn't great because the two of them together then caused, Kigali to have a little bit of some worries about what that
worse,
meant.
Worse paranoia than usual.
Right, exactly. And then they actually had an attempt on Kayumba's life. He was shot and he survived that. Mm-hmm. And it was following that that they formed my father and Kayumba and two other exilees in who were based in the USA. They formed the official an official opposition party called mm-hmm. the Rwanda National Congress, the RNC. Mm-hmm. And that, like, formally put a wholesale target onto them that they were well aware of. And, yes, in January 1st, 31st, depending where you are in the world, that the eventuality of that was that my father was killed, as you said, mm-hmm. by what I will say, I mean, I suppose I should say allegedly, but, I mean, the family is pretty certain that it was at the behest of the Rwandan government because those are the only so-called enemies. Mm-hmm. They had, although they would never formulate it as being enemies of the state of Rwanda. All they wanted was true democracy, space for criticism, and, you know, proper civil and political rights, as well as human rights to be respected.
Mm-hmm. On that issue of, there's several been findings. There was a trial. Some were captured in the case of the General Yamwasa. And there was conviction of the immediate individuals who, I guess, were involved in the acts. Incidentally, of course, there was more than one attempt on General Yamwasa, if I remember rightly. But just to go to that point, the South African authorities did say, and I guess the judge himself said, that he thought that the assassins came from Rwanda. That was his finding, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Now, in the case of the assassination of your father, Colonel Patrick Karegeya, Africans, do they have this under investigation? What is the status of that?
Immediately following his death, preliminary sort of inquiry, it was more or less certain that to some extent, you know, Rwanda might have been involved. So the only sort of consequence and immediate action that happened was South Africa cut diplomatic ties with Rwanda, mm-hmm. and I don't believe they've been restored to date, as far mm-hmm. as I know. Mm-hmm. And they continued with their investigation, and as a family, we've been informed that the case is more or less closed, and they know how it happened, when it happened, and the perpetrators. Unfortunately for them, though, the perpetrators more or less the same day of the murder had already expatriated themselves, you know, back to Rwanda.
So the killers are in back have returned to Rwanda.
Yes. At least that's what the investigators let us know. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, South Africa does not have any trial that were to take place would need to involve extradition mm-hmm. of the perpetrators. And unfortunately, they don't have a formal extradition treaty. For my money, even if they did, I doubt it would be, you know, respected, because you'd have to have a trial for extradition. And, you know, that mm-hmm. would go on and on and on.
Yes.
So that's kind of where we are. It's like we know who did it, but we kind of can't do anything about it. And also, South Africa has sort of its own internal politics. Mm-hmm. Right, that are keeping them very busy, and this is now kind of an old story that they're not going to revive and put resources towards when they're trying to sort of save their own political clout in the country.
There's a phrase that is chilling to think about, but often is voiced by people who study these things. They say, for reasons of state, justice is not done, simply because it would be awkward, awkward for governments. This is indeed a real tragedy because, of course, first of all, it's a family tragedy and your personal loss.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a political tragedy in that there is no mechanism for a solution, at least at this moment. But I'm really curious I want listeners to know that while the evidence points at Rwanda, and certainly the courts have found these, and most media, and by the way, we should congratulate the Canadian newspaper, the Globe and Mail, who looked into this matter. They certainly are convinced that the government in Kigali engages in political assassinations around the world when they feel they need to or wish to. But there was other evidence.
They engaged in political intimidation. More so than assassination. I mean, my father's case is kind of a rarity. Internally, yes.
Yes.
They disappear and kill people from time to time. But I believe my father's case is the sole extraterritorial assassination that has taken place. Although there are some reports in Kenya as well of journalists and such.
Well, there's certainly a number of bodies who've turned up who Mr. Sendashanga in Nairobi, but for example, but you're right. I mean, but this one certainly, this is very important because, of course, this is a matter of people with credentials within the same organization, and I suppose we need to ask you what you believe is behind this. But before we do that, I want to ask you, and certainly share with our listeners, what really shocked everyone about the assassination of your father, Colonel Patrick Karegeya, was that the government of Rwanda went out of its way, leading personalities, to say things which were shocking, frankly, including shocking their closest ally, the United States. Even the representative Samantha Power said she was unhappy with what was said. Tell us about what happened after. Were you shocked? What happened following the assassination of your father?
I mean, yes and no. I was shocked by perhaps the callousness of, you know, high-ranking individuals. So my brother engaged in a Twitter exchange with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and it was somewhat shocking, like, that she responded, and to the children of the, you know, assassinee in such a callous manner. That was shocking. But the sort of, but the general kind of, you know, unfeeling response, or rather supportive response towards the government is not surprising at all, because people are acting in the name of self-preservation. That's what I put it down to, in my personal opinion. I'm not going to, you know, paint with a broad brush to everybody, but I believe that the reason that things that you find shocking is because they have to stay on the side of good, because if they do not, what happened to my father will also befall them, and they're well aware of that.
That little extra venom that they showed seemed to be a government that was using murder as a way to intimidate. In other words, to basically send a message. This is indeed, I think I'm almost quoting him verbatim, that the president himself said, this is what happens when people oppose us. But and I can tell our listeners, if they were to Google this, there's no disputing this in terms of the tone. And actually, I must say, much of the reportage was basically on the language and demeanor of the government, which was such a revelation to people.
I mean, yes, you have to, you know, we will say alleged because there's been no formal finding, but I mean, the president himself did say that he said, we didn't do it, referring to my father's murder, but I wish we did it, you know.
Yes.
Which is, to me, that's like more or less really not so subtly veiled confession. Or, you know, something in line with that. But, yeah, again, I think it's just, for all intents and purposes, it's like a thought-policed state. You know, you have to be very careful what you say, where you go, with whom you interact. And, I mean, we barely have contact with our own family members because they don't get in touch for fear of what will happen. And we are just by association. My mother was his wife, I am his daughter, but, you know, that's how deeply the fear runs, that even like blood-related family members are afraid once someone is blacklisted, you know?
Yeah, well, indeed, out of conscientiousness, for yourselves, you must think, well, maybe I shouldn't bother this person for fear that they will be...
No, exactly.
...be brought into problems.
That's how... this is what an effective authoritarian state looks like, is that, you know, you instill fear enough to the point that the people will police themselves.
Exactly.
You don't even have to do anything because, I mean, nobody is going around saying, don't talk to so-and-so, but you know not to.
Yes. The atmosphere, preparing for this, I noticed our listeners should know that you had a very prominent gospel singer. Everybody loved him. His name is Mahigo. He had a song about reconciling the population of Rwanda, in which he crossed the line on the on President Kagame's policies, and he ended up, what is it, 10 years in prison for his song?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what the atmosphere is.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us, what is your best, your father, by the way, wrote about this, and I'm very proud. We actually interviewed your father on one occasion years back, but he did explain the differences in why this was all happening. Can you roughly sketch it out for us, what your father's thinking was about the problems with the present government of Rwanda?
Well, yes. I mean, in our conversations that we had, it was basically that it was kind of a founding, it seemed to have taken, you know, the form of being a founding principle that in order to take charge, you needed to have total control of everything, and people needed to be controlled, and therefore the press needed to be controlled, and you can't have any opposition in order to get the, like post-genocide, there needed to be total control. But even after sort of forming the basic institutions, there was no attempt to make them inclusive. And then also there was never a formal, I know he lamented that there was never a real formal process of reconciliation between, you know, Hutu and Tutsi, which is a very, very controversial issue that I wouldn't even pretend, like having lived outside of the country for so long, to be properly informed about on how one would go about that. But that's just another important touchstone, for example. And then, unfortunately, you know, people didn't pay enough attention, and then power became concentrated in the hands of essentially one man, and few people, but they are very loyal.
It's an amazingly one man show. He seems to travel a lot. He's always having his picture taken with somewhere in the world, and it's always just him. It's a very remarkable situation. Was the Congo Adventures involved in this dispute at all? The trouble they were having in eastern Congo, do you know?
Yes. My father was very opposed to the second war. And they had much conflict over that because he thought that they didn't need to be a second incursion and that they could have tried, you know, talking about it with Kabila, having peace talks. And that was a point of contention. And it's fine because, of course, my father was overruled. He's not the head of state in any way. But his sort of opposition, just on a personal level, led to that personal conflict between himself and Kagame. Unbeknownst to him at the time, but then later very clear that, you know, his just generally opposing his policies was an issue, which,
Well, it's a very, very important matter. I think your father is an emblematic figure, and it's a tragedy for your family, but it's obviously also a tragedy for the Rwandan people and the justice system of South Africa. Everything has been stressed by this. And Portia Kerrigan, please.
Nothing, the only hope that I guess what me and my family take hope in is that nothing lasts forever. You know, that time carries on and he ages and he can't be in control forever and ever and ever. And, you know, history tells the story that oppression doesn't, people want their freedom. And I have to believe that eventually the Rwandans themselves will, you know, demand it in some way or form.
I think you're right in that, and we're very glad that you talked to us today. Portia Kerrigan, thank you very, very much for being
here. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That
was Portia Kerrigan. Her father was Colonel Patrick Kerrigan. He was murdered by assassins, most likely sent by the government of Paul Kagame in Rwanda. And certainly that was the conclusion of the Globe and Mail, which did excellent reportage on that. Jeffrey York, I'm sorry to say I don't remember the co-author's name, but I know they did really brilliant. They should, I don't know if they won a prize, but they should have.